Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. He is Bill Miller, the legendary mutual fund manager at Legg Mason. He most famously beat the S&P 500 for 15 consecutive years. The math behind that is just mind-boggling. It's something that couldn't possibly have been a random act. Michael Mauboussin discusses this in great detail and talks about the skill level. He very famously blew up in the financial crisis, meaning the fund crashed and burned along with everything else. And people kind of wrote him off as having, all right, that guy's done. We'll never hear from him again. And over the past 5 years, he's again crushing the market, beating the S&P 500 by 400 basis points a year. Consistently being in the top handful of funds every year. He is really a fascinating guy, super intelligent, very thoughtful about things like valuation. He's incredibly circumspect about his experiences during the financial crisis and talks quite with great humility and quite bluntly about what he got wrong during the crisis. I always find that refreshing when someone has a bad run, and instead of saying, oh, it was the Fed's fault or this person's fault or what have you, basically owns it and says, yeah, I failed to understand the difference between this recession and that recession. Here's what I learned. Here's what I wish I would have known during the crisis. It was just an absolutely fascinating conversation. If you're at all interested in asset management, running a mutual fund, running a portfolio, how to be a value investor, how to come up with a unique value add that allows you to beat the market, and perhaps more interestingly, Bill Miller's criticism on the failure of active management being that so many managers are suffering from career risk, and so they become closet indexers. He has in great detail described why the move towards passive investing is actually a rational response from the investing community, from the public. Hey, why are you paying a lot of money for an active manager who is essentially a closet indexer? He's essentially not only similar to the index, but his portfolio is going to be wholly unable to beat the market because it's essentially a closet index, plus a high fee. Get out of that and either go to an active manager who has a chance to beat the market, or just index. And he's pretty blunt. Hey, most people are better off indexing. So I just found this to be an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I think you will as well. So with no further ado, my conversation with Bill Miller.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is a legend. His name is Bill Miller. He is the former chairman and chief investment officer at Legg Mason, where he ran the Legg Mason Capital Management Value Trust for many years. He was named by Morningstar in 1999 the fund manager of the decade. Bill Miller beat the S&P 500 from 1991 through 2015. 15 consecutive years. It's a feat essentially unprecedented in mutual fund management. Since then, he's been running the Legg Mason Opportunity Trust and just launched, or that's really not the right word for it, LMM is the new fund, a new firm that he's in charge of. The Legg Mason Opportunity Trust Fund has beaten 96% of its peers over the last 5 years and has outpaced the S&P 500 by 2% annually. Bill Miller, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry. Nice to be here.
So that's quite an introduction. What you did with the fund is really legendary. We're going to get into the streak in a little bit, but let's talk about your approach. Is it fair to call you both a value investor and a contrarian?
I would say, yeah, I'd say that what I am is a long-term oriented value investor with a contrarian overlay.
That's a pretty fair description. So let's talk about your process. How do you begin the process? How do you approach selecting stocks?
Well, what we're trying to do, the team's trying to do, is find companies that trade at large discounts to what we call intrinsic business value. Mm-hmm. And intrinsic business value is the present value of the future free cash flows of the business. And then we're also looking for companies where you're starting out with low expectations, where people don't believe that the future looks very bright or that there's a lot of controversy. And then with that, the key, we use every valuation technique known to man, but the key one that we're always starting with is free cash flow yield. So just under a checkbook accounting approach, like you have your own checkbook,
right?
We want companies that ideally will start out with a 10% free cash flow yield. And yeah. There's nothing magic about that. That's just a heuristic that we've developed over the years. It tends to work, but higher is always better as long as those free cash flows are sustainable.
How does this differ from classic Graham and Dodd value investing?
Well, the classic Graham and Dodd approach was an approach that focused mainly on accounting metrics, and so PE, price to book, price to cash flow, those kinds of things. And toward the end of his life, Ben Graham made a point that those things no longer work because they became replicable, and they didn't identify companies that were mispriced. They tended to identify companies if the valuation statistics were superficially attractive. Those were typically companies that had lower returns on capital. And then unless those returns on capital changed, those low accounting metrics didn't give you outperformance.
How important are the growth metrics? For a while, GARP was quite the thing in the 90s. Is growth at a reasonable price significant? Do you bring growth into your metrics?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not so much growth at a reasonable price so much as it is that growth is an input to the calculation of value. And so companies that grow faster, other things equal, assuming they're earning above the cost of capital, are more valuable than companies that grow more slowly. The cash flows will compound more quickly.
How do you balance the current fundamental picture of a company with what you hope the future prospects are going to be? How can you judge how the business will grow and develop?
Well, there are many, many ways to attack that issue. One of the things that we try and do, if the economy is in recession, for example, or the economy is in a boom, we will tend to normalize that. So if the economy is growing more rapidly than normal, when we're looking at a company, we will bring it back to a normal growth rate. If the company, we're also looking at the company economics, and those are typically a function of the industry economics. Mm-hmm. So you start out with industry economics, you look at company economics, quality of the assets, quality of the management. All of those kinds of things go into trying to figure out what the company's going to do. And you know that a company like General Motors, for example, is going to be a company that's a very mature, slow growth company operating in an industry that has global overcapacity, and it's under a lot of technological threat. So that all goes into thinking about a company like that. Amazon's our largest position. That's a completely different exercise, because Amazon is a completely dominant company with an enormous total addressable market and incredible competitive advantages. So it's going to have a growth rate of, you know, right now roughly 30% a year, which is unheard of in a company of $100 billion of revenues.
How do you deal with something, and let's stay with Amazon, where there really isn't a whole lot in the way of profits, but they're certainly taking market share and they're certainly growing revenue like wildfire?
It comes down to, again, the issue of accounting-based metrics versus economic metrics. So with Amazon, their natural business is one that has a marginal return on capital of triple digits. And when people say Amazon doesn't make any money or doesn't make much money, what they're really looking, I think, at the wrong sort of metrics, because everything below the gross profit line at Amazon, they consider an investment. Mm-hmm. So some of those investments are capitalized, some of those investments are expensive. But Amazon, if you do a little bit of math on it, a little bit of statistics, what you'll see is that Amazon's share price historically, it isn't correlated with profit growth. It isn't correlated with cash flow growth. It's correlated with the growth of gross profit dollars. And so the faster the growth rate of gross profit dollars, namely what they have to invest, the higher the valuation that the company has been able to attain.
Yeah, that makes some sense. So let's talk a little bit about size. Your fund started at $750 million back in 1990, and it didn't take very long. 15 years later, it was over $20 billion. How does that change in size affect your ability to be nimble.
It really didn't. And what's interesting about that is that while the fund got to 20 or 25 billion, I think, at the peak, we had another 50 billion of institutional assets to go along with it. So the overall money under management in that one strategy at the peak was around 75 billion. And what we observed anyway, is sort of ironically, is that as the assets got larger, the performance got better.
Amazing.
And then, of course, what happens is that the assets always peak with the peaking of performance, because if the performance kept up, the assets would keep going up.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Bill Miller. He was with Legg Mason for the longest time before he took himself private. Is that a fair way to say it? LMM is now 100% owned by yourself?
It will be, yeah. It's currently 50% owned by Legg Mason and 50% by me, but I have a deal to buy them out, which should close in the spring of 2017.
So let's talk about your streak. You ran the Legg Mason Value Trust from 91 through 2015. You actually ran it longer than that, but in the middle of that was a 15-year streak of beating the market every year consecutively. There's never been anything like that before, and there probably never will be since. So what's the secret?
Luck. There's a lot of luck into it.
Hold on. Let me write that down.
Yes.
A little luck. But in all seriousness, it can't just be luck. It's got to be some combination of some skill, some luck, some right guy, right place sort of thing.
I'd say, I mean, Stephen Jay Gould wrote a piece on streaks, the late paleontologist, mm-hmm. and he noted that every streak, he went through all the different sports streaks and stuff like that.
I was going to say paleontologist / baseball fan.
Right, yeah. And he noted that every streak is some combination of skill and luck, mm-hmm. depending on the length of it and how it's achieved and stuff like that. I'd say the thing that contributed to it probably the most was a pivot that we made in 1995. Mm-hmm. So 5 or 6 years into it, when technology stocks got very cheap because people were worried about a recession.
Right.
And you may or may not remember that Jeff Vinnick ran the Magellan Fund at that time, and it raised a lot of cash because the Fed had been tightening.
Right. 94, there were some issues in the economy. People got nervous.
Exactly. So what happened then was that you could buy companies like Dell, which is a relatively new company at the time, at 5x earnings.
Wow.
You could buy Nokia at 6x earnings because people were worried. And they also didn't properly analyze those businesses. Dell was growing 35% a year, trading 5x earnings. So we bought Dell then, we bought Nokia, we bought America Online, another one that went up 50 times after we bought it. What we did was unusual for value investors is we got into technology at that time. And most value investors following Warren Buffett's kind of dictum that he didn't own technology, he didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. We, through some work that we'd done with the Santa Fe Institute, came to understand the economics of technology were different from what people traditionally believed. And it was much more predictable than people believed.
So let's talk about AOL for a moment, since you mentioned them. That was a 50 bagger that went up 50x. In the real world, how do you hold on to something that goes up 5x, 10x? Investors are notorious for quote-unquote ringing the bell too soon. How do you withstand the ups and downs of a stock like that was somewhat volatile and ride it till it's a 50-bagger?
Yeah, it's interesting. Part of the thing is you have to try and understand the potential of the company. General Motors is not going to be a 50-bagger, right? General Motors mm-hmm. is a mature company. AOL was a very new company, a small company in a very big new area. So it had a lot of potential. We didn't know it was going to go up at all, but it certainly had the potential to do so. And so that's really trying to understand what the company's possibilities are, what the total addressable market for the business is. And the other part of it is that when you get it, when it becomes a big winner like that, and it becomes a bigger and bigger part of the portfolio, part of what happens is that just from a portfolio management technique, it becomes riskier in the sense of it has a greater and greater impact on the portfolio, and that becomes a question of how you size the position.
Well, that leads to another question. Do you ever have an upper capacity, nothing can be more than 10% of the portfolio, or some line in the sand, or what do you do with?
There is no line in the sand. We actually, part of the reason that streak went on and part of the reason I was manager of the decade was that with AOL and with Dell, for example, both were 50 baggers for us, but they got to be as much as 20-25% of the portfolio, which
each.
which had never happened before. Fannie Mae was 14, I think, at the peak. Uh-huh. And then we fortunately were able to cut them back and get them actually out of the portfolio end of 1999. But that was very unusual. Probably the biggest we would go, and we've been since then, is I think Amazon got to 12 or so earlier or late last year.
So you start accumulating AOL and Dell mid-90s. It's an incredible five-year run for technology. What, other than the sheer size in the portfolio, what are you doing in 1999 to cull those back? Is it just those two because of their outsize position in the portfolio? Or are you looking at the macro environment? Are you looking at technology no longer as cheap? What's the thought process like in 99 and 2000 when you're selling two giant winners, capital gains and all?
We went from 38% of the portfolio, I think, in the beginning of 2000 in tech, to no percent by the end of the first quarter. And the reason for that was that the market had been going up 25% a year.
Right.
And corporate earnings had been growing very rapidly, and valuations got way out of whack. So back at that time, as you may recall, you had Microsoft was 60 or 70 times, Cisco was that, GE was 50 times, Home Depot was 60 times. So the valuations were just way, way, way out of whack for mega cap and for technology. And part of our thought, as we looked at companies like Dell and AOL, it wasn't so much that the total market value of those businesses was way out of whack with the potential there, but what we did know was it wasn't going to be linear. There would be some interruption there, and when that interruption came, the companies would get killed. So what? And then the Fed was tightening at that time,
right?
And I think the real trigger for me in that environment that really kind of put paid to the whole thing was it was twofold. Number one was there was a headline in the New York Times in March of 2000 about Julian Robertson. It's called the end of the game, or the end of an era, and it talked about how value investing was dead,
right?
And about Julian Robertson had to close up shop, and at Buffett, of course, had done poorly for
underperformed,
several,
right?
Yeah, done poorly, and then so that was kind of one trigger that everybody had thought that was dead, and the second one, maybe more important one, was that from the spring of 1999 to the spring of 2000, the first quarter of 99 to the first quarter of 2000, the NASDAQ was up 100%, and the Dow was down. And again, that bifurcation was so large, and the valuation discrepancy was so large. And I'd say that the final part of that whole thing was, at the end of the first quarter in 2000, something like 65% or 70% of active managers beat the market in that quarter,
mm-hmm.
and which is an extraordinarily high percentage.
Number.
And at the same time, there were only two sectors of the 10 or 11 S&P sectors that beat the market: utilities, mm-hmm. and tech. So what that told me, and nobody was owning utilities, right? So what that told me was everybody was crowded into tech. Everybody's overweight tech. There's nothing more to go in that. And then that coupled with valuation said it's time to go the other way.
That's quite fascinating. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Bill Miller. He is the former chairman and chief investment officer of Legg Mason, perhaps best known for really an unproducible streak, beating the S&P 500 15 consecutive years when he was running the Legg Mason Value Trust Fund. Morningstar named him the manager of the decade in 1999. Let's talk about the new, for lack of a better word, the new shop, LMM. Tell us a little bit about the firm and its history.
LMM was created in 1999 when we started the in 1999 we started the Legg Mason Opportunity Trust, and it was created as a joint venture between myself and Legg Mason. And it was the only Legg Mason subsidiary that wasn't 100% owned by Legg Mason at the time, and the idea was that Legg Mason and I would be partners in that particular fund, whether it did well or not. And so that was run coextensively. LMM was run coextensively with Legg Mason Capital Management, which I was the chairman of. And then in 2012 mm-hmm. or so, Legg Mason decided to combine my subsidiary, like Mason Capital Management, with ClearBridge, which is a New York-based equity shop. I did not think that was a particularly good idea. And so what I was able to do, because I had operational control of LMM, was to extract that from that transaction and set it up as a separate entity and a separate business. But I had to then go restaff it from the standpoint of trading and reporting and production and compliance and all that kind of stuff.
That was back in 99?
No, that was in 2012.
Okay.
So it was run as a joint venture. Yeah, run as a joint venture for most of that period. And then in 2000 and I guess 14, we moved out of the Legg Mason building into our own space. And then just this year, we reached a deal, Legg Mason and I, where I would buy them out and buy the now two funds that are advised by LMM, buy that advisory firm out.
So the two funds are the Legg Mason Opportunity Trust,
right,
which you've been running
since inception, since beginning of 2000.
Yeah. And it had a so-so 2000s, however, it's been on fire lately. Fair way to describe it?
Yeah. I would say, I wouldn't say so-so 2000. Had a very bad 2007 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the best performing funds in 2009. It was the single best performing fund of all funds in 2013. I mean, 2012. And then
right.
the best performing fund of all funds above 50 million, 2013.
And there's about a billion three
in that domestic version of it. And probably the most unusual thing about it, which will never happen again, is if you open the New York Times special section on mutual funds of 2 weeks ago, you'll see that the Opportunity Trust was the single best performing fund of all domestic funds in the third quarter, and then the single best performing fund of all domestic funds for the last 5 years. And that will probably never happen again.
So here are the numbers I'm showing. It beat the S&P 500 by 200 basis points on average every year for the past 5 years.
Yeah, that's probably right, yeah,
and
at least, yeah.
And over, I want to say, 7 years, it beat 96% of its peers. And what you're now telling me is for the trailing 5 years, it was the top, it beat all of its peers.
Yes, correct.
So, and that quarter probably had something to do with that. So tell us about your co-managers. Who else runs the funds with you?
I do that fund with Samantha McLemore, who has been with us 15 years. She started out as an analyst and moved up to being an assistant manager, and now she's co-manager of the Opportunity Fund. And then we have an income fund called the Miller Income Fund, and it's run by my son and I. So
I was going to say some
that.
Guy named Bill Miller runs that one also.
Yeah.
Bill Miller IV.
My son and exactly.
And tell us about the Income Opportunity Fund. What does that focus?
Yeah, that's a really interesting product. We started it internally in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to do it as a joint venture with the Legg Mason's Western Asset Management subsidiary, but we couldn't get the product people to approve it because it was designed to deliver high income as opposed to being a bond fund or an equity income fund. It just could go anywhere in the world to get high income. And so it was hard for them to come up with a benchmark. And finally, after 5 years of results, they said, okay, the record's good enough that we should launch it anyway, which we did. So the objective here is very simply high income, giving you income higher than the high yield index with the possibility of also preserving capital, the opportunity for capital gain. So the current yield, current yield on it right now is around 7.5 to 8 after expenses.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Bill Miller. He is a legend in the world of investing, not only for the greatest S&P beating streak of all time, but for his legendary stock picking. Let's talk a little bit about the current environment and how things are operating. I want to give you a quote of yours and have you respond to it. You recently said, "Stocks are stupidly cheap, but bonds are ridiculously overpriced." Discuss.
Well, stocks are stupidly cheap relative to bonds.
Okay.
That's my view. I believe that taking bonds first, you know, we hit a level over the summer where bond yields globally had never been this low in the 5,000 years of history that we have about bond yields. Mm-hmm. So they're the most expensive they've ever been in history because of the aftermath of the financial crisis and slow growth and all of the stuff that we read about every day. And even if you go back a year ago, right? So a year ago, the 10-year Treasury yielded over 2% to like 2.15%, mm-hmm. and now it's 1.75. So again, this year, bonds have beaten stocks. And so what you have now is a situation where stocks yield more than bonds. And the median PE ratio in the S&P 500 is about 17.5, which is above the long-term historic median, but miles below where it theoretically ought to be if this is the right level of bond yields. And so I think one of the things, and we have a partnership that we're just getting underway, and in that thing, I'm long a portfolio of stocks against a short position in the long treasury.
Long a portfolio of stocks against short. Oh, so really, you're doing a full-on paired trade, long equity, short
bonds.
Yeah, I
think that we had a 35-year bull market in bonds from 1981 till this summer. Mm-hmm. I think we hit a double bottom in bonds in 2012 at around 138 and then around 135, I think, this summer, and mm-hmm. Rebounded sharply from both of those levels very quickly. And if you look at the way that bonds have traded, the way the safe parts of the market have traded, so utilities, telecom, consumer staples, since the summer, mm-hmm. they've all begun to wobble. And so all of that tells me that this 35-year bull market is probably over. We had a 35-year bear market from 1946 to 1981, followed by a 35-year bull market.
So it's time for the cycle to turn, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also we're in a secular bull market in stocks mm-hmm. that began in March of 2009, and I think that lasts until, like all secular bull markets, stocks get too expensive. But they're not too expensive today. They're not anywhere near as expensive as they were in 1999 or in 1968, you know, or in 1987 in the summer, for that matter.
All right. So you said a number of things that demand a follow-up question from me. First, you mentioned the double bottom in bonds. Do you look at charts, and how important are they to you?
Yeah, I think charts are a way for me of visualizing fundamentals, looking mm-hmm. at the supply and demand, you know, expressed graphically. I don't think that there's any special magic to charts. The academics have studied this in a variety of ways and haven't found sustainable, reproducible a way algorithmically to use charts. But nonetheless, what they can help you visualize what's going on and what has happened. And again, it's a supply-demand thing mainly.
Mm-hmm. And then the second question is, so the internal debate we've been having about secular bull markets, some people define a secular bull market as starting from a higher high. So the argument has been made, if this is a secular bull market, it might not have began until 2013 when the S&P and the Dow broke out of that previous high, I guess 2007 high, and started making all new price highs. And other people are just, well, you could take the trend and extrapolate it for what you want. Do you even care about the definitions, or are you just looking at, hey, this is something that could last an extended period of time?
There's all kinds of different ways to kind of measure bull market episodes cyclically, secularly. I tend to think of a secular bull market as one that starts at very low valuation and starts at pessimism. Mm-hmm. So starts, you know, the end of one bear market, a bottom, and then the peak being when you've reached a point where if you look out 10 more years, you don't earn any rate of return, you earn a very low rate of return. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, from that standpoint, the previous secular bull market was 1982, summer of 1982,
sure.
to the end of 1999 or the spring of 2000, where you had roughly 17% a year from the bottom to the top. And it's important, at least the way I tend to think about it, to understand that a secular bull market like that encompassed the crash of 1987, encompassed recessions, encompassed declines in the market. Just because the market goes down or you have a recession doesn't mean that the bull market is over. I mean, the economic cycle might be changing, but mm-hmm. the bull market is over when you can no longer earn a decent rate of return by owning owning equities.
So 82 to 2000 was defined in large part by a fairly continually expanding PE multiple. It looked like investors were willing to pay more and more for each dollar of earnings. Are we seeing anything remotely like that here? And theoretically, how long can something like that go for?
I again, different people have different views on this. My view is emphatically no. We are not seeing that. We did. We had obviously very cheap stocks in the spring of 2000. The S&P
but
was
briefly,
600.
It felt like stocks were cheap for 10 minutes, and then suddenly they looked expensive again.
Well, again, because the market leads the economy, so the mm-hmm. stocks went up before the earnings came through. But right now in the overall marketplace, if this is the right level for 10-year treasuries, 175 or so, mm-hmm. and 2.5 is the right level for 30-year treasuries, then the right level for stocks is not 17.5. It's probably 30 or 35 times.
Really?
So I think that the market right now is already discounting a rise in the 10-year probably to 3 or 4% over the next several years. So putting it differently, I think you can have the 10-year get cut in half in the sense of double the yield on it
right.
without that harming stocks.
So let's put that into a little broader context. We get a December increase, which, what does that bring us up to, 50 basis points?
Maybe,
it's
yeah.
kind of hard to say, wow, that's a heck of a tightening. And then theoretically, they do a quarter, four times next year, and four times in 2018, and we're still only at 2.5%. You're essentially saying that shouldn't derail an equity market rally. Stocks can continue to grow despite that move.
I would be very surprised if they did 4 and 4. I think you're probably looking at 2 and 2 mm-hmm. as opposed to 4 and 4. If they did 4 and 4, it would only be because the economy was growing rapidly, much
right.
more rapidly than they
then,
think it is,
then
in
it
which
is
case
now.
Earnings would be higher. That mm-hmm. you know, so I think that the greater,
so that's the optimistic.
The greater risk is that they you know tighten too soon mm-hmm. into a fragile economy, and again I don't see how they do 4 unless the rest of the world is also starting to grow
right.
as well, because the dollar would come.
So under. let's say a quarter point in December, and then 2 in 17, and 2 in 18, and 2 in 19, and 2 in 20, which would mean that we would have a low inflation environment, a GDP 2%, something along those lines,
maybe a little
and the
slower.
Rest of the world coming along. No, nothing. That almost, to quote my friend Larry Kudlow, that's a Goldilocks scenario, isn't it? If you have low inflation and low growth.
If you look at it right now, so it's astonishing to me that you have this year again people pulling money out of equity funds at the fastest rate since 2008, when the world was falling
right.
apart. And you have that when, if you were just to sit back and abstractly say, what's the best environment to own stocks? You'd say, oh, well, you want to have economic growth, but mm-hmm. it can't be too fast to stoke inflation or to cause the Fed to get hostile. We have to have low inflation, so we're not, PE ratios can be high. We want a good beginning dividend yield and a good dividend growth rate. We want GDP to be at an all-time high. We want household net worth to be at an all-time high. We want profit margins to be at an all-time high. All that's true. And yet valuations right now are nowhere near the historic highs.
So it's the political season. We're having this conversation before the election. Given everything you've described sounds so good, why is there so much negativity about everything, about the country, about our policies, about stocks, about bonds? It seems you can't go anywhere without this drumbeat of negativity, despite what you're describing as things actually being pretty good.
Yeah, I think that the 2008, the financial crisis and the housing collapse mm-hmm. kind of changed the psychological polarity of people with respect to savings and investment, and made them, I'd say, both risk and volatility phobic. Mm-hmm. And so they're terrified of risk, and especially if they saw their house drop 35% in, you know, from peak to trough, and that we had an unemployment rate that hit 10% at one point. And then there's just the general anxiety and angst that you see whenever macro pops up. I mean, the stock market had the worst start to a year in history this year,
mm-hmm.
just because people got worried about oil, about Russia, about China. So these fears flare up, and I think they're due to the financial crisis, and it's just going to take time.
We've been speaking with Bill Miller, formerly chairman and chief investment officer at Legg Mason Asset Management. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out the podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue talking about all things value investing. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com, or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. We love your comments and feedback. Write to us at MIBpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Seeing what others have seen, but uncovering what others may not. Global research that helps you harness disruption. Voted top global research firm 5 years running. Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner and Smith Incorporated.
Welcome to the podcast portion. Bill, thank you so much for doing this. I'm very pleased to meet you, and I'm really enjoying this conversation.
Thanks, Barry, and I've been a big fan of your writings for a long time, so it's great to meet you too.
I don't even know what to say to that. I'm struck dumb by that. There are a few questions I didn't get to in the radio portion, and I want to circle back before we start doing our favorite questions. And there's a bunch of different things that I know you can sink your teeth into. So let's jump into some of these before we come back. God, there's so much stuff. So at the peak, what were the total assets you were running at Legg Mason?
They were north of $75 billion.
Is that 2000 or 07?
That would have been 07 probably.
And basically you're buying all big caps. You didn't feel ever constrained by, gee, there's only so much we could do with this money. It's too much money now.
In the early days, we did all caps. So again, we had almost no money under management. We started with zero under management, so we could do anything. This is 1982 when
I think
the first portfolio that we put together in the summer of 1982 had a 7.5% dividend yield and traded at 4x earnings and a discount to tangible book. At the peak, we were mainly large cap. But again, because we're contrarian value investors, we were liquidity providers when people wanted out of something. So the size of it didn't matter too much. It didn't affect us too much. And it's my friend Will Danoff, another guy who's beat the market over his entire career, runs the Fidelity Contra Fund. It's the biggest actively managed fund, and he's got a great record with $100 billion in assets. So it's
doesn't make that much of a difference. So let's talk about how you got to Legg Mason. What were you doing before you were running the Value Opportunity Trust?
I was a very young treasurer at a privately held company called J.E. Baker, which sold refractories to the steel and cement industry. And I got to Legg Mason because my wife was a broker at Legg Mason. So she had when we got married overseas when I was in the Army, and then I went back to Baltimore to go to grad school at Johns Hopkins. And so when I was in grad school, she got a job at Legg Mason, and then that's how I got to know the people there.
And what was your first gig there? What were you doing for them?
I came in to succeed my now late partner Ernie Keeney as director of research. So when I was a treasurer, I was doing the normal treasury functions, bank relations, and all. But the Baker Company had a fairly significant stock portfolio that they managed internally, which I did as well. And it was that I think caught the attention of the people at Legg Mason and some of the people that she knew there.
So this is the first I'm hearing of this. This is interesting. So you're working at a company selling refractories to heavy industry, but sort of as part of your job, you're managing their own internal portfolio. Was that for their pension?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, part of the pension was managed outside, and so we had a pension committee that evaluated managers, and then part of it was managed internally.
What was your academic background that you had any sort of skill set, and that you're in your early 30s then at that point, right?
When I got to Legg Mason, I was 31 years old. Yeah.
Oh, so you were in your 20s running part of the pension fund.
Yes.
What was your background? What was your schooling?
Well, I had an undergraduate degree in economics and European intellectual history from Washington and Lee in Virginia. And then I went to grad school at Hopkins in the PhD program in philosophy. And between that, I was in the military intelligence overseas.
Oh, really?
But I'd been interested in stocks since I was very young. In fact, it's an amusing story that people have written about. So that people say, how did you get interested in stocks? When did that happen? And it happened when I was 9 years old. And I was living in Miami at the time, and I came in from mowing the grass. And my dad was reading the newspaper, and he had to turn to the stock pages, which, of course, don't look like the sports section or the comic section, right? Just numbers and letters. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, these are stocks. I said, what are stocks? And he said, well, they're parts of a business. I said, why are you looking at this? And he said, you can make money if you know how to pick stocks. And I said, well, what do you mean? Show me what this means. So he takes something. I'll just make up a thing. Say General Motors. Right? So he says, there's GM. That's the car company that makes Chevy and Buick. And I'm like, okay. And I said, what are those other things? Well, that's the price. There's the opening price of the stock and the closing price. And I said, what's the thing at the end? And it's like plus one quarter. He said, well, that's the change. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, that's a quarter. That's 25 cents. And he said, so if you owned the stock the day before, you made 25 cents. And that, I said, well, what do you have to do to make it make money? And he said, what do you mean? I said, what do you have to do? How do you make it make money for you? He said, well, you don't have to do anything. It just does it by itself. And I said, wait a minute, there's a thing where you can make money without doing any work? And he said, yes, sort of. And I said, well, that's what I want to know about, because I don't like to do work, but I do want to make money. And so, and that's how I got interested in stocks at that, you know, at that point in time. And there was a book, which is probably still out there, that Merrill Lynch was giving away, called How to Buy Stocks by Lewis Engel. Uh-huh. And it was in order to familiarize people with the you know, with the stock market. And it told the story of some little kid that started a fishing pole company, and that didn't, it was kind of a, you know, parable about stock buying. And since, you know, since then, I've always been just interested in stocks.
What was the first stock you remember buying?
The first I remember buying was RCA. Uh-huh. In the 1960s.
Oh, so you're a kid then?
Yeah. I bought RCA with the money that I had made by having a paper route and umpiring baseball games and doing stuff like that. And RCA stock doubled, and I used that money then to buy a car, first car, when I was like 17 years old. It's a Triumph TR4.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So there's a tremendous history of interest in the market, but still you're working for a non-financial company. How did you start managing their pension fund? That sounds like you were 28 or 26. You were running their part of their pension fund.
Yeah, I mean, I worked for the CEO directly for a couple of years, and oversaw a variety of different things, and then I was also named the assistant treasurer, and the treasurer was the one, got much older than me. He was the one running the portfolio, and I was helping him with that, you know, doing research and doing stuff like that. And then he left for another job. And the job was vacant. And so, again, I was very young. And they're like, well, you can be the interim treasurer, and we'll go find a treasurer. And after about 6 months, they didn't find one, so they just let me do the job.
That's amazing. You know, the other thing that stands out that you had referenced was military intelligence. We've spoken to a number of people who have had military experience. How did that affect your approach to investing? The U.S. military is a very specific organization with its very own way of doing things.
Directly on investing, there's a really interesting connection that's probably only because of the military intelligence training.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, with the SEC, nobody wants you to have inside information, information other people don't have. But you can have what they call a mosaic approach, where you put pieces of information together and figure something out. And we had extensive training in military intelligence in that exact thing, which is taking disparate bits of information and using them to create, in essence, a picture, probabilistic picture of what might be going on and what could happen, and looking at various scenarios. All of that is directly applicable to, of course, to looking at companies and looking at the information and trying to get a picture of what's going to happen with those businesses and the economy.
From just apparently unrelated bits and pieces information about the companies.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, there's... You know, they have these old cliches that they would have on the bulletin boards of loose lips sink ships, you know, and stuff like that. And it's true, because you could look at something that apparently was meaningless and have a little bit of information, but then there was something over here and something over here that were unrelated on their own, but you could put them together and get the beginning of a picture when each individual piece by itself didn't tell you anything.
And it's the same approach with picking stocks.
Very similar. Yeah, very similar.
Huh. So I want to throw another quote at you from yourself. I often remind and get your feedback on it. You had said, I often remind our analysts that 100% of the information you have about a company represents the past, and 100% of a stock's valuation depends on the future. So explain that.
I'll come at the two different ways. One of them was that from roughly 1989 and 1990, we had two bad years in the value trust. And I took over at the end of 1990, solely managing the fund. And part of what I did then was I went back and looked at the history of value investing and the academic research on value investing. And it became clear to me that a lot of what people thought about value investing wasn't supported by the evidence, and that when I looked at our own mistakes, they were generally speaking caused by putting too much emphasis on past data and past valuation stuff and past growth rates, and not enough on the future and not enough on what companies could do. Mm-hmm. And so that got to that point of where I came up with that particular quote. And we changed our approach at that point in time to put a lot more emphasis on a company's ability to earn above its cost of capital, to generate free cash flow, and to reinvest that on a sustainable basis.
So how do you go about pivoting? You have an approach that's been extremely successful. What makes you say, we're going to tweak this a little bit and change the way we're doing things despite the past track record?
I got that actually from the late Sir John Templeton, mm-hmm. who was asked, you know, why he followed this value investing approach. And he said, we don't follow it out of any special reverence for that approach. We follow it because we keep looking at all different ways to do things, looking at ways to improve all the time. And it just so happens that this is the one that we found most effective. And so I think that was that. And I talked to him about this, you know, when he was alive. And that was one of the things that stayed with me, is you're always looking to try and improve the process. So if it turns out that even for a brief period of time, that looking at charts tends to be correlated with significant stock price moves, fine, we'll then add that to the mix until it doesn't work anymore. So it's a process of really trying to continuously improve. And again, yeah, I think you had Mike Mobison,
sure,
on here, and he was
twice.
He was a great when he was working for us. He was a great teacher of security analysis to the analysts, and always looking for ways to improve, looking at the academic literature.
So how do you prevent yourselves from oversalting the stew, so to speak? It becomes really easy to constantly, you know, I picture the old soundboards with all the knobs and everything, and you have all these different inputs. Here's valuation, here's the Fed, here's interest rate, here's inflation. How do you prevent yourselves from playing too much? Because you could, there's always something to be tweaked. It's harder to do less than it is to, doing more seems to be easy. How do you prevent that natural tendency to want to play around the edges a little bit?
It's a little bit like the Zen, like doing, not doing, in the sense mm-hmm. of, in the sense of what we're trying to do is always think about how things could be improved, assess it. But we're long-term investors, and that's rare in this market. But you know, we owned Fannie Mae for 15 years at one point. So it's the case that our average holding period is 3 to 5 years. And then so we're looking through the stock price fluctuations. We're trying to look through the noise, and we're always trying to filter out the signal from the noise. But the core part of the core part of the process doesn't change, which is trying to figure out the intrinsic business value.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that, because that I think is really fascinating. How does that process begin? How important are analysts bringing ideas to you, and how significant is the team approach that you employ?
So all those things are important. I tend to be a high output idea generator, not in the sense of constantly putting new names in the portfolio, but in the sense of constantly looking at names. And after 35 years of doing this, you know, I have a fairly good extensive experience with all kinds of different companies and industries. And you know, my son's been doing this for 8 years, and Samantha's been doing it for 15 years. We have a new young analyst and a more senior guy that we just brought on. So there's a mix where people are all looking for things that we think are mispriced on a longer term basis.
All right, and your co manager at the Opportunity Trust Fund, whose name is, give me one sec, Samantha McLemore. So how do you guys divide responsibilities for running that fund? Is having a co-manager challenging? Is it helpful? Is there a natural split of duties? How does that work?
Well, it works very well. We don't have a formal split of duties. We both are trying to pay attention to everything in the portfolio all the time. Mm-hmm. She's in the office a lot more than I am, because I split my time between Florida and Maryland and New York. And so she will tend to take more meetings with sell side analysts, take more meetings with companies than I would, just because she's in the office more. And then we're, you know, we're, her office is right next to mine, and my son's is right next to hers. So it's when we're there, we're talking all the time. And when we're not there, we're emailing back and forth or talking on the phone.
So let's talk about the end of the run, which was 91 to 05. What was so different about 07, 08, 09 than the prior sell-offs like 2000 or 87? What made this collapse different than any previous? I mean, the dot-com crash was pretty brutal, at least for that second. What was qualitatively different about the Great Recession?
This was, up until that point in time, the academic literature did not really distinguish between the types of financial crises and then how you deal with those crises. Mm-hmm. And so what we got wrong in that was, I thought we had a pretty robust strategy for dealing with financial panics and upsets. And in fact, we went through an exercise where we said, let's make sure that we have a strategy for dealing with anything that happened in the post-war period since World War II. Mm-hmm. So high inflation, Watergate, you know, wars, panics, all that kind of stuff, inverted yield curves. And so that's why we did pretty well for many, many years. This particular crisis was different because it was an asset-based crisis and not a liquidity-based crisis. And most financial crises are liquidity-based in that the Fed will raise interest rates, so the discount rate goes up, you know, the savings rate goes up, companies cut back, you have a recession, then the Fed comes through the other way. Even the crash of 1987, same thing, which was that when the market crashed, you had interest rates that got to 10% in October, and mm-hmm. you had a 2%, 2.5% yield on the market, and that just sucked all the money right out of the stock market. But when it crashed, the Fed cut rates dramatically, liquidity went in, and the market came back, and the economy came back. In this case, it was an asset-based crisis, so basically housing related, mm-hmm. and housing is most people's largest asset. It's the asset that secures most of the debt, and a lot of that debt was undocumented loans, liar's loans, and stuff like that. So when that edifice came down, what we thought was when the Fed began to really inject liquidity, you could go back in again. And as it turns out, that's correct in a liquidity-based crisis. It's not correct in an asset-based crisis. An asset-based crisis, similar to what we saw in Japan and what we saw certainly in the U.S. In 2008, is you only go in that when the authorities get together and try and stabilize asset prices. That was TARP. That's what TARP did. Up until mm-hmm. TARP, every time there was a problem, the bank failed, the shareholders were wiped out. And TARP came in and it stabilized the asset values of the banks and therefore the banking system. And that was the bottom. October was the bottom when most stocks made their bottom, when most asset prices made their bottom. The final bottom was made in March, but that was more technical bottom.
You had an October 08 bottom and then a March 09, and that was another.
But there were no significant failures after TARP, and that was what allowed the system to stabilize. As late as January of 2009, people were still talking about nationalizing the banks, but nothing ever came of it.
So you have your own internal process. How do you, as a fund manager, how do you come to the conclusion, hey, we're on the wrong side of the trade here? How do you recognize the error, and how do you adjust your process to reflect the new information? A lot of people have a real hard time making that pivot.
Oh, I think that's a very difficult thing, because when you're doing poorly relative to the market, then the question is always, is the market wrong or am I wrong? Mm-hmm. And that's a very difficult thing to answer, because the future isn't knowable to anybody. And the market is a sort of a collective intelligence machine. So it's easier to do at the individual stock level, because, and to give you a good example, if you take 2011, for example, we had a very bad year in 2011. And people thought it was going to be another 2008. Then they thought the euro was going to come apart, which would have been a catastrophe. But in 2008, if we looked at the individual names in our portfolio, 2007 and 2008, generally speaking, they were not meeting our expectations in terms of fundamentals. They would miss a quarter here, a quarter there. The stock would sell off. We're like, well, okay, it's been marked to market on that. But there was a sort of a continual slippage of what we expected the fundamentals to be. And in 2011, there was no slippage at all. The companies continued to do really well, even if the stocks weren't doing well. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one for us. Then second is just when we go in on a name, one of the things that we ask ourselves once we've decided to buy it is, what will make us wrong? So trying to decide up in advance how strong is the investment case and when will we know that we're wrong. And one of the things that we have learned over the years is you don't let the stock price tell you if you're wrong. The stock price might tell you something is going to go wrong, mm-hmm. but the stock price by itself doesn't contain any information, especially in this environment where 70% of the stuff is algorithmic, where prices are being marked against each other every day.
So that raises another question. How does HFT, high frequency trading, how does that impact you when you're either looking at stocks to select or making the decision to hold on to them?
It doesn't make much difference to us because we're longer-term investors. I think there's a real issue of the front-running and the stuff that can affect shorter-term traders. To us, the market structural change, which is mostly just a reaction to the crisis, is the layers of risk management and the way people manage risk. That's what's making the market, I think, much more difficult and problematic. And the reason for that is that now that everybody is so risk phobic and people are when they see drawdowns, they run and sell. But what at Legg Mason, we had since the crisis three additional layers of risk management that were added to the overall firm. And what all risk managers want to know is what's your risk mitigation strategy. And they don't ask what your risk mitigation strategy is if you're outperforming or the market's going up. It's only when you're underperforming or the market's going down. So what that does is it bifurcates the notion of risk, right, to only focus on stuff that's going down. And as I've said many times, I've never met a risk manager anywhere in the world that believes you should own more of an asset that's falling in price. You should be selling an asset that's falling in price because it's risky. But you iterate that across the entire market, and uh-huh. what happens is that stocks go down a lot more than they would otherwise do so, because at each different level, there are people who are selling just because it hits a threshold, down 5%,
so
down
it's
10%.
The new regulatory scheme that we see at companies is a modern version of portfolio insurance?
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense. I'm not arguing with you. I'm saying, from a aren't returns generated by reasonably embracing risk? Isn't performance the flip side of assuming some risk?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when people talk about volatility and they're worried about risk, when you put your money all in cash, it'll just sit there and look at you, won't do anything.
Right.
So my colleague Samantha is fond of saying that volatility is the price you pay for performance, and I think that makes
sense.
I think that's right.
Volatility is the price you pay for performance. So there are lots of giant firms now. You have Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street and firms that are managing in the PIMCO and firms that are managing in the trillions. Do they all have? I'm asking if you imagine they all have the same sort of layer of risk management, and is that going to affect everybody's ability to produce asset management that can rationally embrace risk?
Well, I'm not familiar with the details of all of their strategies. Many of those firms that you mentioned are passive. Many of their assets are passive.
Right. Vanguard is $4 trillion, two-thirds of it is passive.
Yeah,
now.
And BlackRock's got the ETFs and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But from the from the people that I know in the industry, in the business, at big firms, every one of them tells the same story about risk and about having to have risk mitigation strategies. And I think that's part of what you're seeing in the overall market.
Huh, that's quite fascinating. What else is different? One of the questions I didn't get to before, I've heard numerous people blame or credit, if you want. This rally is all driven by the Fed. It's low interest rates. Nothing else is driving this market. How accurate is that assessment?
I think it's reasonably accurate as it relates to bonds globally.
And but they're not talking equities.
Well, I think it's much less accurate with respect to equities. And so just for example, if it were all just low interest rates that's driving the rally, right? What's the most interest sensitive part of the economy? Housing. How's housing done? Housing stocks have been underperforming, and the housing market itself is half of what it was in 2005 in terms of new home deliveries.
Right.
So that hasn't been you would expect that would be, you know, blowing the doors off if it was just interest rates. How much have interest rates helped Amazon, for example? None. Google, none. Facebook, none. Those are among the largest companies in the overall market. How have interest rates helped J.P. Morgan and Bank of America? No, they hurt them. So it's a much more complex situation than just the stocks are marked up. And as I said, I believe the market's already discounting 3-4% 10-year rates.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll see.
And that's 5 years or so off in the future.
Probably, yeah. But the thing I think is more interestingly possible is that the only time that we saw money going into stocks was in 2013 during mm-hmm. the so-called taper tantrum.
Right.
When yields went from 160 to 320 in 4 months or 5 months. And that's the only time that money's gone out of bond funds and into stocks, because people were losing money in bonds for the first time. And now money's gone back into bonds. So what did the market do that year? It was up 30%. Because money flowed into stocks, not out of stocks. And I think that's a potential that most people aren't focused on, which is if we have a bear market in bonds, and it doesn't have, if bonds go from 175 to 225, right? But people start losing money and that goes into stocks, the stock market could go up, you know, 20-30% easily.
Huh, that's quite fascinating. I've been hearing stories of cash on the sidelines now for 20 years, and I've always ignored it because how can there be cash on the sidelines? If I'm buying a stock from you, you're giving cash to me, and if I sell a stock to you, and vice versa, there's always some amount of cash ready to be deployed. That's really fascinating. The bond side of things. So you've owned a lot of financial stocks. You mentioned just now J.P. Morgan and others affected by the Federal Reserve. What was it like heading into the financial crisis, sitting in financial stocks? What was the analysis then? Was there a sort of sense, hey, these are really inexpensive and we want to own more? Or was the sense more along the lines of, we're not really sure how this plays out, this is sort of uncharted territory?
It was more the latter, because what we did as the economy and the market got worse is we moved up the what we thought we were doing is moving up the quality spectrum mm-hmm. and buying the larger and stronger financials. As it turned out, you know, so we bought AIG, which was at one point a AAA rated company,
the best insurer in the world.
Yeah. So, and that, you know, effectively disappeared during that, during that point in time. So I think from our standpoint, the big break for us in that financial crisis was when the government took over Fannie and Freddie that Sunday in September. And my personal view is that when people say, well, the letting Lehman Brothers go was the mistake that caused the cascade of, you know, then the breaking the buck and the credit markets coming unhinged. And my personal view is, or the question I ask people to say that is, well, why did Lehman Brothers fail in September? Bear Stearns failed in March.
Right.
And nothing happened from March till September, then Lehman failed. And to me, the answer is Lehman failed because Fannie and Freddie were seized the week before. And they were seized even though all their capital requirement met all the statutory capital requirements. And they were seized preemptively. And I came in that Monday morning and I said, if the government is going to seize and wipe out the shareholders preemptively, not when the company runs into liquidity trouble like Bear Stearns did, then we can't own any financials. We have to get out of every financial, which we did. And I think people who had their looked at the same thing. Who's the most levered next to Fannie and Freddie? Lehman. Let's get out of that one. And then who's the most levered after that? Merrill Lynch, WAMU.
So you liquidated following the Fannie and Freddie. That was late August or early September?
Early September, like September 7th.
It was a week before Lehman blew up. So that had to save a ton of capital if you were liquidating on the 8th. It must have felt bad at that day, but you look what happened a few months later.
We actually got back in after TARP.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't out for that long. And what really helped is when the government came in with TARP. And again, we shouldn't have gone in as quickly after that as we did.
Sure.
But in January,
you had a nice bounce after that. October, November.
Yeah. In January, what happened when they were talking about nationalizing the banks, that the preferred stock of Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, was trading at like 50 cents on the dollar when it was pari passu with the government's
right.
money. So we bought those preferreds. at the time. And then what happened was that the government caused those preferreds to be converted into common stock at roughly par. So we, you know, our, I think our cost on our Citibank was like 70 cents a share and stuff. So we that was part of the reason we did so well in 2009 was those things took off like a rocket.
That's fascinating. You know, my view of Lehman Brothers has always been it was merely the first trailer in the park when the tornado came in. And as long as there was so much financial paper written on based on mortgages and home prices were dropping, hey, the whole dominoes were going to fall. It didn't matter which one was which. I don't know how much of that is philosophically appealing, but I've always liked that metaphor. A lot of people blame Lehman on the rest of the crisis, but it looked like everything was going down no matter what it was, as long as home prices were in free fall.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So I know I only have you for a finite amount of time. Let's jump into my favorite questions, the standard questions I like to ask all my guests. You had told us about your background and what you did before Legg Mason. Tell us about some of your early mentors. Who were the people who influenced your professional development?
I would say because I got interested in stocks at a fairly young age, and I read a lot on stocks. But I'd say that the stuff that influenced me the most was probably Adam Smith's The Money Game, which came out in 1968 or 1969.
Sure.
The follow-on to that, you know, Super Money, where actually he introduced the world to Warren Buffett. So I started reading about Buffett. Read Ben Graham at the time. Reminiscences of a Stock Operator is something that up until a couple of years ago I read it every year because it's such a great lesson in psychology and how psychology works through the market, how markets behave. So those were some more. You know, my partner Ernie Keeney, who died in 2010 at the age of 92, I worked with him every day for however many years that was. 25 plus years. So he was a big influence on me. And the major influence that he had was he was probably the most optimistic person, most optimistic I've ever met. And so no matter what, no matter how terrible things looked, he would say, well, they'll get better. Things will turn up. You know, everything's going to be okay. And he was also extremely patient as an investor, owned stocks forever. And was a deep value kind of a guy. And in fact, he got to Legg Mason. He came to Legg Mason and headed up the research effort there after he'd spent his career at the telephone company. And the reason he got to Legg Mason, which was a very small firm at the time, he came in 1968, was because that his personal account had gone up so much. And the broker that was dealing with him said, you know, this guy is, you know, this guy's in his 60s. You know, and he's going to retire from the telephone company, and we need to get him here because this guy can really pick stocks. And that's how. And he came and joined the firm.
Really?
Yeah. After retiring from the telephone
company.
That's
amazing. Any other mentors you want to mention?
Well, certainly. I mean, people that you know, I've tried to get to know and pay attention to all the prominent value investors. So certainly Warren Buffett, John Templeton have been big influences on how I think about things.
And you mentioned a few books. You mentioned Money Game and Super Money and Reminiscence of a Stock Operator. What other books are some of your favorites? Be it finance, not finance, fiction, nonfiction. What do you read?
Well, I kind of read I read very widely. Let's just say it's
okay.
And so I'm always reading stuff that is people are kind of surprised to.
To
hear about.
I just spent 15 minutes talking to Bill McNabb about science fiction.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to go outside of Reminiscence. What else?
I'll just kind of rattle off stuff.
Sure.
And so if I stay in the business thing, in the market or business realm, Fortune's Formula by Bill Poundstone is a great read because it's about Claude Shannon, the guy who created information theory, and J.L. Kelly, who came up with the Kelly Criterion, which is how you allocate assets in any type of an environment. And but Shannon made a fortune in the stock market, and that book points out the differences between standard financial theory and the type of theory and behavior that Kelly and Shannon use. And it's just a great intellectual read. Two books that things that have influenced my thinking greatly: William James Pragmatism, 1907. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most important document in American intellectual history.
Really?
I think, and his other book, one of his other books called The Varieties of Religious Experience, also very interesting, interesting book. Mind and Cosmos is a recent book by Tom Nagel, a philosopher.
Okay.
Again, I went to grad school in philosophy, so Hume's Treatise of Human Nature is Hume, Kant, you know, they're all, I'm reading Schopenhauer right now, the two volumes of The World as Will and Representation.
Mm-hmm.
Some stuff that I'm reading right now, I'm just about done with the brand new biography of Douglas MacArthur. There's a new one of Ulysses S. Grant that just came out that'll
Who
be
Who wrote
next.
The MacArthur book?
I'm drawing a blank on it right now. Not H.W. Brand.
If it's new,
It's brand new. It's an 800-page book.
All right,
and it's good. It's very good. I've read Manchester's book on MacArthur, and but this is good. Let's see. I've this year always trying to read some classics. So I read Robinson Crusoe and Frankenstein.
No kidding.
I'm reading the book that came out that a lot of people read. Obama's recommended it, *Sapiens*, by Yuval Harari.
Danny Kahneman recommended that book. I've had a number of people come out. I started it not too long ago. Are you enjoying it?
Well, I finished that, but yeah. He has a new book out. It's called *Homo Deus*.
Yes.
And I'm about halfway through that, and it's great. It's great.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm trying to pull up the. The MacArthur book, but.
You looking at Amazon? Just look under Amazon MacArthur bio.
Yeah, whatchamacallit is not cooperating. This is Explorer, and it doesn't want to remotely cooperate. All right, I'll dig it up.
Yeah, you mentioned science fiction, which I don't read a lot of, but I actually have just started Olaf Stapleton's book Star Maker, which is a famous book in the science fiction pantheon.
He was a philosopher
by training who wrote what he didn't even regard as science fiction, just called it, you know, speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a book that's gotten had an exceptional influence on other science fiction writers, and I haven't read it.
So that's quite a run of books you've gone through. It sounds like you're quite the reader.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time reading. I wish I spent as much time as Mr. Buffett does, who says it's all he does all day is read, but I have other things to do.
So, to say the least. So, what do you we talked about some changes in the industry. What do you see as the next round of changes? What is the next thing to impact?
I think we're about halfway through the secular change in the industry away from active management and away from it's a traditional mutual fund industry, which is under great secular pressure, both from ETFs as well as from passive. And I think passive is right now about 30 to 40%
mm-hmm.
of the industry. I think that probably goes to 70.
That much?
Yeah,
that
over
high.
Time. And
wow.
I think we're halfway through that. I think we're just at the beginning of a massive hedge fund shakeout. To where the fee structure in hedge funds just makes no sense whatsoever in a low nominal rate of return world. I mean, having a fee structure in an equity hedge fund of roughly equal to the 10-year treasury just makes no sense whatsoever. And if you're going to make 5% a year in stocks, which we think is a reasonable number, then having that level of fees and then taking 20% of any profits takes almost all the profit, unless you have a hurdle rate in there, and gives it to the manager, which, again, doesn't make any sense.
How much of the move from active to passive is being driven by a similar fee pressure?
Well, it's a lot.
Is it performance? Is it
it's,
fees?
It's a lot less because the fees are lower compared to hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
But again, people have thought, for some reason or other, in a mental accounting mistake, that some other hedge funds were magical and they deserve these higher fees. I think the problem in active to passive is twofold. Number one, fees. Jack Bogle has said that's mm-hmm. that's money directly that doesn't belong to the customer anymore. But second, and more importantly, I think it's closet indexing. And closet indexing is driven by, you know, a combination of risk management and also a fear of tracking error. So, you know, people can take some underperformance. I remember having a conversation with John Reed when he was running Citibank. I think it was probably 19, want to say the late 1980s or something like mm-hmm. that, early 1990s, I guess it was. And he said to me, and we were an owner of Citibank at the time, and he said to me, you know, he said, you have a very tough job because you have to actually beat the market. If you don't beat the market for some period of time, people take all your assets away. And he said, on our side of the business, he said, in terms of managing people's money, he said, all we have to do is not look bad. He said, mm-hmm. so we don't really have to beat it as long as we don't underperform by too much. Because he said it's a different mindset that people, different people's mindset have with money being run by a bank versus being run by a mutual fund company. But I think that the closet indexing, an academic told me that by his count, over 70% of active managers aren't really that active. They're pretty much closet indexers.
So it's all career risk. They're afraid of sticking their neck out. And so they're charging fees, but essentially running an index with a few changes around the edges.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that
can't, in the aggregate, that can't work.
So is that the largest source of money that's moving from active to passive? It's moving away from the closet indexers to the true indexers.
It's moving away from. I mean, we're getting redeemed this year. We're not having a great year, but after 5 years of the number one fund, you would think that we'd be getting a lot of inflows. We're not, right?
Right.
My friend Will Danoff, who runs the Contra Fund, right? He's got a 25-year record of being the market, outflows every day. Chris Davis, same thing. Mason Hawkins, same thing. So I think it's a shift from active just in general. And so it's not so much that people don't know that of all the managers I just mentioned, all of them have a record of beating the market over long periods of time. So it's not that people don't believe that they can't beat the market. It's people don't want the market – they don't want the drawdown and the risk that comes with anybody who's truly an active manager.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. That's very insightful. So what do you do to relax outside of the office?
Well, reading is relaxing for me.
Okay. That's a good start.
I have a bulldog, an English bulldog, so he's always a source of amusement. And then, you know, psychologically, you know, patting the dog is relaxing. It's one of those things where I'm lucky that the market is both a hobby and a profession, and so I spend a lot of time just, you know, reading about economics, markets, that sort of thing.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So the last two questions, these are my favorite two. I ask this of all of our guests. If you had a millennial or a recent college graduate come to you and say, Mr. Miller, I'm interested in becoming a fund manager. What sort of advice would you give them?
Well, the first thing, I'd start asking some questions like, why do you want to be why do you want to do this? How is your interest stoked in this? It's the people that I've found that have been the best at this have tended to be people that have been interested from a young age. Not surprisingly, Tiger Woods, you know, started golfing at age two. So the younger you start, I think the better off you're likely to be. I agree mostly with Charlie Munger. I always ask people, you know, what they're reading, whether it be markets related stuff or Charlie says that he's never met a great investor who wasn't a great reader. I'd say that's mostly accurate in my experience. Then in terms of what I tell them is that one of the things you really want to do is just you invest. So do you invest right now? What do you do with, even if you have a small amount of money, what do you do with it? I started investing $25 a month when I was in the Army as a lieutenant in the Templeton funds. And I'd, you know, read the quarterlies, and I'd also ask if they want to be a fund manager, which fund managers do you admire and why? Questions like that. So, and in terms of advice, it's you know, it's a tough business to get into. Having a business school degree from a good business school has pluses and minuses. But one of the pluses is you're more likely to get a job in finance with that. But again, I don't have that, and a lot of other people that I know don't have that. But just getting into a money management firm. So if you can get a job anywhere at Legg Mason or T. Rowe Price or Fidelity or that I think is the key. Once you're inside, then your ability to maneuver and to make friends and to figure out where you can go is much greater than it is trying to have your nose pressed against the window.
And our final question, what is it that you know about value investing today that you wish you knew 30 plus years ago when you first started?
Well, I'd bring it a little bit more up to the current, and I'll answer that in two ways. You know, I wish when I'd started that I had had a better understanding of how values created by businesses. I had a good understanding of how people in the stock market have invested and done that kind of stuff. But really understanding, I'd say, the economics of various businesses in a way that Buffett seems to have a natural tendency to do. I think I've developed that over the years, but it would have been nice to have it if I was 25 or 30. Second thing would be, the big thing, the big changer for me would have had to understand the difference between an asset-based crisis and a liquidity-based crisis. Mm-hmm. So those are the only two possible kind of crises that there are, except for, you know, world wars and stuff like that. Had I had that understanding that I have today as a result of reading the academic literature and the work of people like John Giannakopoulos at Yale, for example, or Gary Gordon at Yale, I think we'd have done really well coming through that 08. So if we have 08 type thing again, which I don't think we're going to have, it's probably once in a generation, but I think we'd be able to deal with it, and that would have made a big difference.
Thank you so much, Bill Miller, for being so generous with your time. We've been speaking with Bill Miller. He is the former CIO and chairman of Legg Mason Asset Management, soon to be running LMM and the same funds he's been running so successfully over the past few years. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you could see the other 100+ of these conversations that we've had. We enjoy your comments and feedbacks. Comments and feedback, not plural. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank Taylor Riggs, our producer, Charlie Vollmer, our engineer, and Mike Batnick, our head of research, who helped put together all the questions for today's show. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Seeing what others have seen, but uncovering what others may not. Global research that helps you harness disruption. Voted top global research firm 5 years running. Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner and Smith Incorporated.